Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. At a meeting of investigative reporters back in 1975 in Reston, Virginia, columnist Les Winton said that what most characterizes investigative reporters is a sense of outrage. During the course of the meeting, attendees decided that the simplicity of the name investigative reporters and editors and the acronym IRE, IRE, was very appropriate. The Investigative Reporters and Editors Conference is currently in San Francisco. Over 1,500 journalists are attending. That's an all-time high. They'll be attending panels and presentations, focusing on strategies for locating documents and gaining access to public records, finding the best stories, and holding the powerful accountable. And today's guests are in town for the conference. David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author. He contributes to Al Jazeera America, National Memo, and Tax Analysts. He also teaches at Syracuse University College of Law and is current president of Investigative Reporters and Editors. And I'm happy after so many times on the air, David, you are in studio. It's great to meet you.
Nice to be here back in the city I was born in.
Yes, great to have you. We're also joined by Sarah Cohen, a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for the New York Times. Sarah previously worked as the night chair at Duke University and as database editor for the Washington Post, and Sarah is vice president of Investigative Reporters and Editors. Hi, Sarah. Thanks for coming
in. Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Great to have you. So as we always do, we start off on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So, David, let's start off with you.
Well, you know, in San Francisco, you have this wonderful nonprofit newspaper, the San Francisco Public Press, which I wish a lot more people knew about. And they have a terrific package about affordable housing in San Francisco, things the city could be doing, innovative ways to approach this. It's typical of the work that they have done from the beginning. It's a nonprofit, non-advertising publication supported by the readers and a broadsheet, and the classic old meaning of broadsheet. It's much wider than the Chronicle. And so they just have a terrific package about things to do to make housing affordable here in San Francisco.
Hmm. And can you give us, what did they come up with? Because this is such a hot issue right now.
Well, first of all, there are a number of properties that could be rehabilitated efficiently and effectively. There is an argument to be made for certain kinds of manufactured housing, you know, prefabbed housing that could be done, and zoning rules. And they've done a very comprehensive job on examining this. And you need to have a diverse economic mix of people in the city. I mean, when I was a boy, this was a working class city. There were factories. you could smell the coffee from Folgers and farmers down in the lower end of Market. There was a produce market down near the waterfront back in the 1950s.
Will you have time while you're here to travel around the city to see all the changes that are happening?
All work, no play this time.
Oh, darn. Well, definitely do it next time, because in my neighborhood, one bedrooms are going for about $3,000 a month.
Oh, I'll bet.
Yeah.
And there's also the controversy about mother-in-law apartments and both the pressure for them and the abuse of the rules.
Right. So kudos to San Francisco Public Press, and we will put a link to that story right after the show. Sarah, what about you? What did you see this week that you thought
was
so
well? Story that came out of Oklahoma on botched executions in the wake of the case from a couple months ago. And what reporters there found was that dozens of cases were probably botched in the past based on autopsies that they did. They looked at every autopsy of every inmate that had been executed over the last 20 years or something and found very low levels of chemicals in their blood. The investigation ended up, we were talking earlier that it ended up helping the prison system figure out what's wrong with its systems, and it's ready to start making some reforms right away.
Well, we were talking about the fact that at this conference, the Investigative Reporters and Editors Conference, you've got a record 1,500 people.
Actually, we have 1,600.
1,600. Okay. 1,600, record number.
So far.
So over the last 5 years, we've seen a dip of about 30%. We've lost 30% of our journalists. David, what are your thoughts on this? Because,
well, we've lost journalists for sure. And at one point, statistically, I think journalist was the fastest disappearing job in the country. On the other hand, our membership is back to what it was at its peak, about 5,000. I think a lot of publishers who were selling pablum and who'd been listening to consultants who would say, well, what do you want to see in the news? Well, you ask me, what do you want to see in fashions? I don't know. I know what fashions I see on the street. I don't know anything about fashions. The job of journalists is to tell you what's important you need to know. And I think a lot of news organizations now realize that if you just serve up glitz mongering, you know, who are the Kardashian girls kissing this week, you don't get an audience. And so we're seeing a lot more coverage, television stations, local newspapers, a whole host of nonprofits that have arisen, like the Center for Investigative Reporting here in the Bay Area, that are doing very good work. And it's because there is, in fact, a market for this. What's really gone away is beat reporting. There are, where I live in Rochester, New York, the county legislature goes sometimes months without any reporter attending its meeting.
Wow. What about you, Sarah? How do you see this, what we're facing
right
now?
Well, I think David's point that there was a lot of very bad journalism going on for a long time is true, and I totally agree with the idea that what we have not lost is kind of the big national investigative series. Those are as strong as ever. I'm just as worried about state house reporting as I am with local reporting. That state government probably affects more people in more ways, and our state houses are emptied of reporters right now, except in a few places. I think that there are some groups that are trying to address that issue, and I think there are some newsrooms that are starting to regret their reductions in staff in state houses. But in the last 5 or 10 years, that's been a real problem for a lot of states.
I absolutely agree. State government has much more influence on your life than the federal government.
Hmm. So what can be done about this? If they regret it, what can they do?
Well, I think that some places are beginning to put more people back on it. I think you see in North Carolina, for instance, where the state house is just in turmoil, that there are some news organizations that are kind of like, wait a minute, we might have gone too far here, and that they're putting people back on it. The other thing is that, you know, it is true we probably need fewer reporters going to meetings than we did in the past. There are citizen groups that are out there looking at it. The records are a little bit easier to get at. You can go listen to your city council meeting if you want to. But what we don't have are the people with the experience and the sources to tell us what it means.
Hmm.
And I'm not sure it matters so much how many people are at the meeting, but how many people are talking to the people to know what is all of this about. There was a great story done many years ago in Chicago where the reporters went through and decoded all of the actions that the city council took, because it was one big package of actions. And there were hundreds of special interests that were involved in one little bill. And that's the kind of knowledge that I think we've lost a lot. Local sourcing, really deep reporting of local and state issues.
I find that organizations like the Sunlight Foundation, where they follow the money, they do a really good job of looking at what happens if a bill doesn't pass. Like, we just had a fracking moratorium in California that didn't pass. And they looked at how much money oil and gas gave to the politicians who voted against it and the politicians who voted for it.
Mm-hmm.
So we do have those organizations, but there's no one there to give that analysis and context.
Well, and you really have to have deep knowledge of people to know who is in the institution, what its history is, how it runs. And Sarah's exactly right about that. In the case of the fracking bill and other things in California, you cannot underestimate how much Proposition 13 took away responsibility from local school boards, county boards of supervisors, and city councils, and vested it in Sacramento. Now, if you're a big business and you have statewide interests, instead of having to go to every little city in the Bay Area, to the 78 or so separate municipalities just in L.A. County, you just go to Sacramento. And the money and the influence in Sacramento, AT&T at one point had tied up every single lobbying firm in Sacramento.
So how does the average citizen keep track of what's happening, for example, in Sacramento?
You know, it's. I think what the issue is that there is very little on the surface that almost anybody can do. I think that the shock of what most of us find when we go into reporters is not what is not what's illegal or underhanded, but that what's legal and secret at the same time. I think that citizens can put pressure on their governments to make records open, so that people who have the time and the skill to deal with them
can get to them. Secrecy is probably the biggest problem we have right now, and the biggest thing that citizens can do is to fight to keep their government open, I think.
Yeah, and we what we need is more coverage of government and less coverage of the politics. Covering politics, political disputes is like covering crime. It's cheap and it's easy. What we really need to focus on is what are these agencies doing? How are they doing it? I mean, I as a somebody who lived in California for 36 years, I can't believe no one has ever taken the Board of Equalization apart. Because I guarantee you there is a first-rate scandal buried in the history and the actions of the State Board of Equalization.
And I covered an insurance commission for a while, and it's one of those really obscure little agencies that has so much power over everything that you do.
Hmm. Sarah Cohn is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for The New York Times. She is in town for the Investigative Reporters and Editors Conference. She's vice president. David K. Johnston is an investigative reporter who won a Pulitzer also while at The New York Times. He currently writes a column for Al Jazeera America, and he is editor of the new anthology Divided, The Perils of Our Growing Inequality. And David is also in town. He's president of the Investigative Reporters and Editors Conference. And if you'd like to join us, if you would like to talk about an outlet you rely on to keep track of what's happening in your backyard or in Sacramento, you can give us a call, 866-798-8255. And if you'd also like to ask David and Sarah, longtime investigative reporters, about investigative reporting, you can give us a call. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So talk a little bit about the state of investigative reporting, say, 20 years ago, and what are the major changes? Sarah?
I think all of us would argue that one of the biggest changes in the last 20 years is the internet, and it changed everything, right? I mean, I never was very good at fax machines, and so now I don't have to be. So in a lot of ways, reporting has become deeper, better informed. It is easier to get things that people want you to know. And I don't think that we should minimize that. Getting a press release from a government used to be a big pain. Hmm. And now it's just, you know, it comes into your inbox and it comes into you in your Twitter feed. You can get what people want you to know really well. I do think that one of the things that's changed quite a bit is that the balance of power has really shifted. I believe that at the same time that we've lost 30% of our reporters, the number of public information officers and PR people who are controlling the news have doubled or tripled. I don't remember what the figures on that are, but it's a wildly different thing. Controlling information has now become a major part of a lot of people's jobs. And so it takes a little bit more sophistication to be able to get beyond that than it used to, while their sophistication at kind of pushing an agenda has become easier. And I do think that's why a lot of people end up falling back on politics a lot, because at least what people are saying is the news there, and you don't have to try to get underneath it as much.
We have to remember that the tradition of investigative reporting in this country was pretty limited for a long, long time. I mean, there was a long period of time when Drew Pearson's column was the major kind of investigative reporting that went on in Washington, D.C., and he would print something, stuff that nobody else would. We had, starting in the 60s, a change about this, and then the incident that led to the creation of investigative reporters and editors, the murder of Don Bowles at the Arizona Republic by organized crime figures there. They bombed his car in the mid-70s. This followed a big growth in investigative reporting, and Watergate contributed to a big increase in it, and we've seen this peel back. There's also a problem of hostility by the courts. There's actually a court ruling in Pennsylvania that an accurate news story about a school teacher who had been convicted of a pedophilia charge was no defense against a legal action because it had happened so long ago, the court said the record was hoary. That is, it's old. Hmm. And there are a whole variety of actions where the courts these days have not been supportive of questioning, challenging, and trying to hold accountable government and other institutions. So I think the biggest change I've seen in the past few years has been this effort for government and other institutions to not hold, you know, to exempt themselves from being held accountable, and this rise of PR people here in San Francisco. Remember, AT&T at one point assigned an executive basically to only monitor and harass Chronicle reporter, columnist David Lazarus, who's now at the LA Times. Not because he wasn't accurate. They were never able to show a single thing that wasn't right on the money because they didn't want people knowing what AT&T was actually doing.
Let's hear from a caller. Let's go to John in San Francisco. Hi, John. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. My question is, where does a citizen go when he has a story that may have been reported in the press or may have been discovered by himself and is no longer getting coverage? And I have a couple of examples. Can I give them?
Sure.
One, I think, was covered by you, Rose, in a recent program with Proposition 13. And based on that show, it seems that the commercial property is getting away with thievery in regards to the benefits of Proposition 13 by not causing their property to turn over for reassessment. So that's a state issue. And then I have a local issue. And this is maybe of concern to you, Rose, because you live here in San Francisco. But did you know that the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission has made a decision to mix groundwater into our legendary high-quality Hetch Hetchy drinking water, and that that decision is going to go forward regardless of whether we have drought conditions or not? So those are two issues I'd like to find out how I can get better coverage on.
All right. Thank you, John.
Well, I've actually written about the commercial issue, but I wrote about it for state tax notes, which is read by serious policy wonks and not the general public. And John's identified a real problem here. The relative burden of property taxes is shifting. And there are also issues about homeowners and exchanges and trusts to avoid higher property taxes when there's a real transfer of the property. But one of the problems in the news business is that once something's been reported, it's not news. Mm. By definition, and it requires creative reporters to find ways to keep bringing this up. And it's a real problem. I also, unless I'm wrong, I think the San Francisco Public Press has written some about this fundamental issue. On the other issue, the groundwater issue, you're going to see, because we are experiencing climate change, all sorts of changes like this, and the Hetch Hetchy is not going to prove to be reliable enough for water. I mean, there are places in the – I wrote about in Newsweek I think in January, there are places in the Central Valley now where the weeds died.
Mm.
The weeds died for lack of water. So you're going to see recycled sewer water, as a number of cities already have, mixing poor quality groundwater with high quality spring water and other things as we cope with growing population, fixed source of water, climate change.
Right. And thank you, John. We'll definitely, we have a drought show in the works, so we will definitely focus on this. And then I think you were referring to the show we recently did about the bill that would make it harder for owners of commercial properties to avoid higher taxes when transferring ownership. David, did you know that the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association supports this bill?
Yes. And you know, good for them, I guess. It is... you know, the fault in Prop 13, which I'll confess I voted for and wish I hadn't, was that unlike Prop 9, which also passed but got fewer votes, Prop 9 only applied to residences. Prop 13 applied to all the properties, and there were warnings back then of what we're seeing today.
Right. So that we'll definitely do follow-ups on that. Thank you for calling in, John. You know, the other question I have is, there, like you said, both have said, there's so much great reporting out there. Talk about, with so much information, easy access to information, how do we ensure that these stories get attention? And I just want to bring up a couple, because there's so much good stuff out there. You brought up the Center for Investigative Reporting. They've got a special on teens in solitary confinement. The documentary Alone is now available online. ProPublica's Justin Elliott has a piece on how the Red Cross is fighting ProPublica's public records request to see how they've spent money after Superstorm Sandy. So that's really great. And then State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration between WITF and WHYY. They've got a really amazing report about two retirees from the Pennsylvania Department of Health who said that health workers were instructed not to return phone calls from residents who expressed health concerns about fracking. This is a huge story. So there's so much good stuff out there. How do we make sure that it gets read and that it doesn't just sort of die after a week?
Well, I'll make a plug for IRE, actually. The IRE.org website, every week there's a roundup of the best investigative stories that they were able to find for the week called Extra Extra, and it's open to the public, and anybody can go on and see what's going on in there. I also think that there's some really good one of the things that does tend to happen is if you get a story like that, that getting other reporters to look at them, they can then look at that same issue in their own area. And I think you've brought up several stories where you could do those stories in lots of areas. And again, to make a plug for IRE, this is exactly what we do at IRE, is to make sure that people know how to do these stories and know how to keep them alive. The other part of it is obviously social media. Mm-hmm. That's where more and more of us get our information. And so I think that everybody can keep these things alive by keeping them up on social media.
And what about places like the New York Times? Because we often talk about ProPublica, the Center for Investigative Reporting, but the AP does really great investigative reporting. The New York Times still does. In fact, we're going to talk with you about the piece you wrote about immigration. Mm-hmm. And the piece is More Deportations Follow Minor Crimes, According to Records. This was a lengthy, lengthy story, and we'll talk about that after the break. But what is the state of investigative reporting at the New York Times?
It's very strong right now. We have a dedicated investigative unit of, I believe, 12 people. I run a small team of data journalists, five or six of us. Almost every desk has a concentration in investigative reporting. We have an executive editor who comes from an investigative reporting background. So at the Times, I feel like we have great support for it. The bar is high to get a story into the Times, though. Mm. It's difficult.
And that's two people in a row who come from investigative reporting, Jill Abramson,
yes,
and now Dean Becquet. Both were first-rate investigative reporters. So the Times is doing a very good job in this. The L.A. Times continues to do quite a good job and maintains foreign bureaus that have done some extraordinary work. McClatchy, which owns the Sacramento Bee, has done consistently very good work in certain areas. And one of the things that's changed, Rose, is it used to be if you broke a big story about agriculture department scandals in the Kansas City Star, nobody else would pay any attention to it. That's changed. That's one of the benefits of the Internet. Now it's much more likely that the Washington Post will now go take a look at this issue. They may not fully credit the people in Kansas City, but
there's that.
But they'll now not ignore it.
Yeah. And just as an example, I mean, a lot of people in the past used to laugh at USA Today, but USA Today has been doing some amazing investigative reporting in the last couple of years.
Yeah.
Just last week, they had a story on general aviation crashes attributable to manufacturers. So I think in the larger organizations, it's good. There are also some very small, not very small, smaller of traditional news organizations that have a real commitment to investigative reporting. I think of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, the Sarasota paper, the Raleigh paper, and they're finding that that's a big draw for their readers. So it's in better shape than it might seem.
I wanted to also give kudos, since you bring up local papers, to the Detroit Free Press.
Yeah.
Jennifer Dixon did a year-long investigation about spending on charter schools, found that taxpayers poured $1 billion a year into charter schools, but state laws regulating charters are among the nation's weakest, and the state demands little accountability in how this money is actually spent. So, a year-long investigation, and it's a really good report.
And the Milwaukee story that Sarah mentioned saved lives. It turns out that all across the country, as part of this, we are spending too much money in government. Babies who are born with a particular condition that if identified through testing and treated in the first 48 hours or 72 hours of life are fine. Otherwise, they end up with terrible health problems. Mm-hmm. Newspapers all over the country pick this up, and it will be better for the lives of many children.
Today we're joined by Pulitzer Prize-winning reporters David K. Johnston and Sarah Cohen. They are both in town for the Investigative Reporters and Editors Conference here in San Francisco. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call here on KALW San Francisco. To take part in today's Media Roundtable conversation, the number to call is 866-798-8255. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We'd love to hear from new voices joining the conversation. If you'd prefer to write rather than call, The email inbox address is feedback@yourcallradio.org, or you can just leave a message there at yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11 o'clock, the BBC's World Have Your Say. Pardon me, no. Coming up at 11 o'clock, it's a State of the Reunion here on KALW San Francisco. The time now is 10:31.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we will talk about the latest Supreme Court decisions. In fact, we'll have all of them by Monday. We'll take a look at decisions affecting cell phone searches, buffer zones around abortion clinics, greenhouse gas emission regulations, and the birth control mandate. This is a big one. This one is coming down on Monday. So what do you want to know about these cases and decisions, and how will U.S. laws and society be affected? That's on Monday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it's our media roundtable, and we're talking about the current state of investigative journalism. Over the past 6 years, we've lost 30% of our journalists in the U.S. Newspaper subscription rates are down, but the number of online investigative outlets has skyrocketed. We've got outlets and we've had reporters on from ProPublica, Center for Investigative Reporting, the Center for Public Integrity. There's a lot of really, really good reporting out there. And so we're talking about what it will take to highlight this kind of reporting and what it actually takes to make changes from this reporting. David K. Johnston is an investigative reporter who won a Pulitzer when he was at the New York Times. He writes a column for Al Jazeera America, and we'll talk about one of his latest columns that takes a look at WikiLeaks releasing a secret draft of an international trade agreement. So far, David is, as far as we know, the only journalist who has written about this, and so we'll talk to him about that. His latest book, it's an anthology, Divided, the Parallel of our growing inequality. He's editor of that book. Sarah Cohen is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for the New York Times. She is vice president of investigative reporters and editors, and they're both in town for the conference. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. What questions do you have about investigative reporting, and where do you go to find these stories? Because the good reporting is out there. You just have to look for it sometimes. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Harry in San Francisco. Hi, Harry.
Hi, yes. Good morning, Rose. I wanted to ask either of your guests, Alan Nairn, who's a longstanding journalist writing about Indonesia and other places, has come out with a report that he spoke with one of the two leading candidates in the Indonesian presidential election, a retired general who has been alleged to be guilty of war crimes. He had a very controversial interview that he disclosed, which was off the record, and I was wondering what the standard practice is with that, what their opinion is about that. I'm glad he did it, but, you know, he's under threat of arrest now in Indonesia. And secondly, I wanted to ask David K. Johnston about, he has said that it's possible the United States would have a revolution, and that would be a horrible mess if that happened. But what circumstances do you think might actually drive people to that? Because I think we see a precursor in that. In that when we saw this couple that came out and shot the police, that seems to be like the mentality he's talking about that might explode.
In Las Vegas? Is that what you're talking about?
One of the hinterlands like that.
Thank you, Harry.
Okay.
Do you want to comment on the revolution first, David?
Yeah, sure. I've actually worried about this for most of my career. When I was 19 years old and a staff writer at the San Jose Mercury, I started writing about people on the far right and the far left. We had a number of bombings. There were like 1,700 bombings a year going on in the country back then. And I began to realize how many people are really estranged from American society. And we're now seeing these people being whipped up, and the economy is not improving. I don't believe it's likely there'll be a revolution. I only believe it's within the realm of possibility. And I think that we should be focusing on getting elected to office people who will solve our problems and compromise. That's how democracy works, and get away from this awful idea that it's my way or the highway. But if we did have a revolution in this country, given how heavily armed this country is, given all the suppressed tensions, I mean, look at all the racism that's come to the fore with the election of Barack Obama. And if we have a woman president, we're going to see an explosion of buried sexism and misogyny in this country. It would be the bloodiest thing the world has ever seen. And so I really think we need to work on rational means, getting along with one another. You know, Lawrence O'Donnell came back on the air the other night. Mm-hmm. He was in a serious accident. And the first thing he did is he pointed out that he was cared for in a first-rate hospital, funded in part by the Koch brothers. And he pointed out, look, I can praise them and appreciate the wonderful things they're doing there, and at the same time be very critical of their public policies. And we need to have civil debate about these things.
A Koch-funded hospital?
Well, yeah, the Koch brothers are very generous. I mean, they got lots of money. And
oh, yeah.
So there's a pavilion at the hospital he was at in New York that's the David G. Koch pavilion, just as their big David is a big funder, or Charles is, of the Metropolitan Opera.
The ballet.
Yeah, the ballet, things like that. I mean, I wish some of the billionaires where I live in Rochester would do more to fund local theater and our full-time Philharmonic Orchestra. So it's a possibility, and it's something we should be aware of. I don't like it when people on the right or left go around saying, you know, all Republicans are terrible, all Democrats are liars. You know, let's figure out how to solve our problems. That was the idea, rational, reasoned debate.
Any comments on the journalist in Indonesia?
I think you got to honor your word no matter what. If you said to somebody, this is off the record, I don't know why you would have an off the record conversation. I don't do that. But you should honor your word.
And I didn't realize that any place that was a legally binding word, though. And that I don't know that in this country we would be in a position of getting arrested for it. However, I mean, we are running into problems with people being arrested for doing their jobs,
right,
and, or not being arrested but under threat of subpoena for doing their jobs. But I'm with David that once you agree to something, it's really incumbent upon us to do what we said. And that's the danger of agreeing to something not attributable and something off the record, is that you're going to learn something that is so explosive that, and then you can't say anything about it.
All right. Thank you for calling, Harry. Let's go next to Faye in – oh, actually, it's an email from Faye. Will the net neutrality issue before the FCC affect news websites? And if so, how?
I'm not familiar with how that would affect news websites particularly.
Yeah, well, the net neutrality issue, which has to do with can some people buy faster access and service – is certainly going to affect commerce. But I remember, you know, a huge portion of the bandwidth that consumers use is either Netflix or porn.
Yeah.
You know, moving news stories doesn't take up much bandwidth on the internet, text news stories.
If only, right?
Yeah, if only. Somehow we got to figure out how to make the news as popular as porn. But there's a real fundamental issue here. I mean, we have a real third-rate internet. Here in California, there are businesses of more than 500 people that have had to move just for internet access. You go an hour and a half north of San Francisco, and you can end up with nothing but dial-up. And, you know, you won't have that happen in Germany or France or Korea or Japan. They got high-speed internet everywhere.
You write about this in the fine print,
In the fine print, yeah. And Newsweek, which I also write for, and in my Al Jazeera columns.
Yeah.
This is a major economic issue that we are building a second-rate or maybe soon-to-be third-rate internet when we invented the internet. And why? Rent-seeking and profiteering by the telecommunications companies.
Well, thank you for the email, Faye. Let's hear next from Ruby in Mill Valley. Hi, Ruby.
Hi, good morning. First of all, you guys and gals are gods and goddesses in our household. We just revere you. We don't know what we would do without you.
Thank you so much.
Digging. And actually, you're very welcome. And that's my question is, do you generate the ideas? Do your editors generate the ideas? Once you get the lead, how long are you given to follow it? How many days, weeks are you able to dedicate to it?
Well, I kind of joke sometimes that we at the New York Times can turn a story that should take a month into a year and a half anytime. So we're probably given a little bit too much time. I hope my editors aren't listening. But, you know, generally the stories are generated from the ground up. And the best stories are usually generated from the ground up. Every once in a while, there'll be an editor-driven story. But almost every reporter really can only get passionate about something that they care, that they've generated themselves. And I think most of the teams that I work on are kind of I almost always work on teams, and the best ones are usually a good beat reporter who knows the subject and knows the people, a great narrative writer who can pull it off from a perspective of a reader, and then I'll specialize in the documents and data a lot of times. And so those are really great teams, and the ideas are almost always generated from the beat. I'm working on a story now with a woman who covers Queens and just saw a few things that she thinks are worth looking into, and they're giving her all the time she needs to do it. So in most places, what would happen is that you'll get maybe 2 or 3 weeks to see whether there is a good story, and then once you are bought into it, most places, if it's continuing to move, they will let you keep going with it.
I just want to mention a couple of the pieces you've written recently. You wrote a piece with colleagues Julie Creswell and Sherry Fink, and the lead says charges for some of the most common inpatient procedures surged at hospitals across the country in 2012 from a year earlier, some at more than 4 times the national rate of inflation, according to data released by Medicare officials early June. While it has long been known that hospitals bill Medicare widely varying amounts, sometimes many multiples of what Medicare typically reimburses for the same procedure, an analysis of the data by The Times shows how much the price of some procedures rose in just 1 year's time.
This is a data set that the government released for the first time in last year, and this year's was for 2012. And we were interested in knowing that this data was coming out. We've always known that medical inflation was much higher than the general inflation rate, but we've really never had a hospital-by-hospital, procedure-by-procedure, or diagnosis-by-diagnosis way of looking at it. So we were really interested in saying, how does this relate to medical inflation? It's from a time well before the American Care Act went to the Affordable Care Act went into effect, so it's a little behind the times, but that was our main interest there.
You have another really great piece, More Deportations Follow Minor Crimes Records Show. A New York Times analysis of internal government records shows that since President Obama took office, 2/3 of the nearly 2 million deportation cases, a record high, involve people who had committed minor infractions, including traffic violations or had no criminal record at all. 20% of the cases involved people convicted of serious crimes, including drug-related offenses.
Right. That was a story that evolved out of some data that was won through a lawsuit by another organization that the immigration officials had to release, and we were among the first to ask for it. And we looked at, I believe it was 3 million deportations records over the last 10 years, and we were really interested in comparing what actually happened with what the government said happened. The president has been on record saying that his deportation policy is targeting gangbangers, murderers, and serious criminals, and we were hearing from advocates that that simply wasn't true and that families were still being torn apart. It's a little bit more nuanced than that, but we were just most interested in comparing words with deeds, and I think that's one of the most important things that we can do as reporters is to hold people accountable for what they say.
What's striking about this very lengthy piece, 11 pages printed out, David?
Sorry.
No, I think it's fantastic. But what's so interesting is there's so much attention on these 50,000 children that are now in the United States in cages. There are photos of them in cages.
And this came out just before that was starting,
right? A couple months. Right. And so you've got a lot of people saying, well, all these kids come here because we've got lax border security and Obama's, his border policies and immigration policy. And yet the reporters don't say, well, wait a minute, he's deported more people than Bush. I mean, why is that missing from this conversation, David?
You've got me as to why, because this is one of those very obvious things where not only is the bureaucracy not doing what the president says he wants as his policy, which tells you he hasn't enforced that on the bureaucracy because bureaucracies respond to what they're told to do. But secondly, the passivity of a lot of reporters covering these things. I think it's partly driven by the TV need to get people to come on the air and to get tight information out of them. By the way, this issue, it's very important to understand that this is a core economic issue. We are damaging our economy by not addressing these issues, and no wealthy society I've been able to find, and I teach the law of the ancient world, has ever succeeded in keeping out immigrants who want to come from nearby poor areas. Just hasn't ever worked in history.
Well, there's also really hardly any explanation about why people are coming. And there's a great documentary that looks at that, Harvest of Empire, looking at U.S. foreign policy in South and Central America.
I just wanted to mention, I think that some of this is a little bit of a catch-22, that in the children coming over was not one of the president's priorities for deportation. So that becomes then a bigger issue because more children are now coming. And a lot of this is about the inability of the president to decide what his priorities really are in this area.
And I wanted to ask you, David, how do you decide what to focus on in your columns? Because I follow you on Facebook. It seems like you're writing every other day.
Because I'm doing different kind of work now, and I'm writing columns, I can be much more productive. And what I do is try to identify issues that I think are not being covered well or miscovered and bring them to attention by pointing out facts that aren't being there, particularly in my Al Jazeera column.
You've got a couple pieces, higher taxes do not kill jobs. That was a recent column. Another one I want you to talk about. On June 19th, WikiLeaks released a secret draft of an international trade agreement involving 50 nations. And as far as we know, you're the only journalist who's written about this.
I'm sure there's somebody else, but none of the major news organizations have written a word about this. There's a proposed trade and services agreement, and the draft part of the draft language was put out by WikiLeaks. It is a model of secret law, and after all, if you had the power, if you're in, to avoid the messy aspects of democracy and push through what you want, why would you put up with democracy? These are not trade agreements in the classic sense of eliminating tariffs and barriers, because most of those are gone. These are about making sure that your intellectual property rights are there forever, that the rules favor the incumbent providers as much as possible. And, of course, thwarting new entrants to markets is very bad for economies. But I am surprised that this didn't get just, you know, even a short spread in the New York Times, it'd be 500 or 600 words about the release of these documents. Because if you read them and you understand how to read them, they're very revealing.
Do you follow WikiLeaks closely?
No. Not
so how did you find out about this?
One of the various alerts I have set up or something I get said that they had released this. So I went and took a look at it and immediately went, oh, my goodness. And then I waited about 4 days. And nobody wrote about it. And that's the point at which I said, okay, now I need to write about this because nobody's doing this.
David K. Johnston is an investigative reporter who won a Pulitzer when he was at the New York Times. He writes a column for Al Jazeera America. You can find his latest pieces at yourcallradio.org. He is in town for the Investigative Reporters and Editors Conference. He's president of IRE. And Sarah Cohen is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for the New York Times. She is vice president of IRE. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. And thank you again for calling in, Ruby. Let's go to Kevin in San Francisco. Hi, Kevin.
Hi. It may be a little late for this question. You mentioned earlier housing, et cetera, in San Francisco. But David's area of expertise, tax, is really relevant because of the tax forgiveness that our mayor gives the tax. And, of course, that draws people in and the city doesn't get revenue. Any comments on whether that's smart or crazy? And it seems like expertise in this area has been lacking in local journalists as to, you know, whether it's good, bad, or what.
Well, this whole issue of subsidies is something at IRE we have a seminar on every year. We had one yesterday. You know, if you have an area that's completely blighted, you're trying to reopen, it may make sense for the government to be doing subsidies. But in every big city in America, we have situations like in New York, there's a lot of discussion that A-Rod, who was making, what, $25 million a year just for baseball, forget endorsements and other things, was living in an apartment worth $20, $30 million, $10 million, some enormous amount of money, and paying the same property tax as somebody who owned like a $300,000 apartment because of the kind of abatement. And here in San Francisco, there's no lack of demand. So there's no reason for the city to be making these deals. I'm astonished, you know, to look at areas like the industrial area just before you get to Hunter's Point, which is now full of housing. Bernal Heights has become a very expensive place to live. And there's only so many square miles of land. So the city needs to really think smart about doing this. And at the same time, boy, isn't it great that the Manhattanization of the 60s that Bruce Brugman made such a big deal out of was stopped, because otherwise the city would be unlivable.
Mm. All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Kevin. Let's go next to Mary in Monterey. Hi, Mary.
Hi, good morning, Rose. And I'd like to say good morning to your panel. Thank you. I wanted to know, when it comes to media, well, I notice that when it comes to local stories or stories of interest, most of the time, especially when it comes to local government, it seems that the way that special interests are embedded with local government and with the local media outlets, that it's very difficult sometimes to get a story out there and keep legs on it, because of the money interest involved. Many times they go after the people, kind of like whistleblowers, but not necessarily if you're working with them, but, you know, like an employee. But they'll go after you in the media, and so they harass you, they bully you, they attack your character, and it's hard to get past this. So it seems you have to do a lot of footwork on your own. And so can you tell me, when it comes to doing that, is there a difference between getting information from local government through a lawsuit, when other people sue, not me, and or Freedom of Information Act, and is one more powerful the other from the other? And can anybody attend your conference?
I'll start with the second question first. That our conference is open to our members, and there are some. We take a very broad view of the word journalist, especially these days when it's very difficult to identify somebody by who pays their paycheck. But it is only open to journalists who are members of IRE. The second question is, when you ask about FOIA versus lawsuits versus, I presume, depositions and other kinds of legal instruments, I mean, the Freedom of Information Act and its local cousins are really a last resort in a lot of ways. They are generally ineffective for most records that you need to get out of the government. There are some categories of records that are pretty effective. Open government initiatives tend to focus on information that the government wants consumers to have, not so much data or information that will help hold them accountable. And so a lot of times you are left to lawsuits and other types of legal instruments that other people have filed, and to whistleblowers and to sources. But really, public records are difficult to obtain in most cases. They tend to have a lot of holes in them, and it's a long, long process.
What about getting facts out of the Obama administration? You both said that the control of information is something this administration understands very well and does very well.
One of our colleagues on the IRE board, Len Downey, did a really interesting report on openness and the Obama administration. So, and I can give you a link to put on your website if you want. But the people he interviewed for that piece talked about the idea that every administration gets more sophisticated than the previous one about controlling information and about making sure that it's sending a unified message through every avenue. We have found it virtually very, very difficult to get any information from anyone but public affairs people these days. Most government employees are under strict orders to not speak to any reporter under any conditions. And the same thing is true with data and documents, that if it's something that the government does not want you to have, it will be virtually impossible to get it.
Yeah, this administration from the get-go has been very troubling about this, and journalists bear some of the responsibility. The granting of a privilege, this is other than on the record, its background, it's off the record, is done by the journalist. But I've had numerous people in the Obama administration say, well, off the record, and I'll go, stop. The George W. Bush administration was actually much better than this administration about this, which is astonishing, given the president's promises about open government. Now, it's understandable that anybody who's president would like to control, because there are all these people who want to leak information because it's their agenda they're trying to get pushed in front of the president, because they're unhappy with something, because they think it's the public. It's important for the public to know something. But it is astonishing the degree this administration has gone, and the effort to go after the going after of James Risen at the New York Times, the implication that he is acting in under the Espionage Act, it should be very troubling to all Americans. You know, the founders believed that we should have a society where government is open and your life is private, and we're getting the exact opposite. That's the direction we're going.
James Risen said at a conference earlier this year that the Obama administration is, quote, the greatest enemy of press freedom that we have encountered in at least a generation.
I would agree. You know, the Nixon administration, for example, they may not like what you said. I had some snarling conversations with people in the Nixon administration, but they respected that it was your job to ask the questions, even if they wish you hadn't been born.
So we've got about a minute left. What are you both working on right now? Sarah, what are you working on?
What can I say that I'm working on?
Oh, what about the piece out of Queens? What's that topic?
I can't really talk about it right now.
Okay.
So, you know, we usually have three or four. I can talk a little bit about our team. We usually have three or four projects going at any given time, and they can range everything from a local project out of Queens to an international project to a national story. So we work on a whole range of things.
Okay.
I'm doing a little different project. I will get an honor from the Trust and Estates Bar, and I'm not a lawyer, but their arguably was their highest honor in January, and I'm going to rewrite the gift and estate tax laws in this country so that they are no longer so porous, so that very wealthy people can escape them and pass forward money that should be taxed and induce integrity into the system. And then we'll see what happens. But I am going to show that it is entirely possible to have integrity and in the gift and estate tax system in this country. You just have to think a little bit differently about it and then draft the code.
Hmm. And what's your next column?
I don't know. I haven't started writing it yet.
All right. David K. Johnston is an investigative reporter who won a Pulitzer Prize while at the New York Times. He teaches business tax and property law of the ancient world at the Syracuse University College of Law. Check out his latest book. He's editor, Divided, The Perils of Our Growing Inequality. Sarah Cohen is a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist for the New York Times. And David and Sarah are both in town at the Investigative Reporters and Editors Conference. And thank you both for coming in.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. What are the implications of the most recent Supreme Court decisions? On the next Your Call, we'll recap some of the key decisions, including cell phone searches, buffer zones around abortion clinics, greenhouse gas emission regulations, and the birth control mandate in the Affordable Care Act. What do you want to know about these cases and decisions, and how will U.S. laws and society be affected? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.